where there's mandatory military service. People at a pretty early time in their careers go into government, military, and intelligence units. And then also pretty early in their lives and careers, they come out of that service and they apply those skills and that knowledge in the private industry. So you have companies like NSO Group and companies like Black Cube that Amy mentioned that do more traditional human intelligence operations that have all of these resources directly from a government that is, of course, as you point out, supported largely by the United States and its military aid. So a lot of these solutions are Israeli as a result of all of those factors.
How much does Israel target Palestinians? So we've talked with reporters like Yuval Abraham from 972, who exposed Lavender and Where's Daddy, where they follow people home, Palestinians in Gaza. Of course, we know about the exploding beepers and phones in Lebanon. And then I want to ask, did you ultimately take down the head of NSO Group, which makes Pegasus?
So first of all, on this question of targeting Palestinians, the reporting suggests, yes, there have been a number of documented cases of spyware technology being found on the phones of Palestinian activists, politicians. We talked to a Palestinian former Knesset member, politician in the film, who puts forward the theory that Israel essentially uses the Palestinian populations as a laboratory for this technology. And, you know, one of the reasons why private spyware companies thrive in Israel is that in addition to the Israeli government's internal, very robust capacity for this kind of espionage, there's always a demand for more of this kind of tech, including from private vendors, to deploy in the conflict that surrounds Israel at all times. Because they are a highly militarized state beset by all of these existential threats, and especially now in this state of conflict, there is just always a context in which to apply and refine this technology. And there has been additional reporting that in this most recent conflict as well, there's been a deployment of Pegasus in an effort to try to track hostages. Now, of course, there's controversy within Israel. People see some of the intelligence failures around this latest conflict, and there's right-wingers who in that country say, well, there should be more use of this technology. But certainly to your question, people who care about the agony of Palestinians right now, I think should be aware that this technology has wormed its way into this conflict and that this conflict has reinforced the development of this technology. To your question about the leadership of NSO Group, I would not say that I took out the head of NSO. The head of NSO was, as we acknowledge openly in this film, a source of mine. He did depart that company amidst a lot of the scandals. The company was very embattled, and then there was a leadership change. The reporting of a whole consortium of international publications, a lot of different outlets, I think, contributed to those scandals. I would say the foremost player in disclosing information about this company was the watchdog group that we track in the film, Citizen Lab.
And Ronan, what could the outgoing Biden administration do to curtail the ability of the incoming Trump administration to use the powers of this technology? Or what could Congress do that you think, given the makeup of the Congress, of the new Congress coming in?
This is where it gets really tricky and, frankly, even bleak. And I think this is why activists and journalists tracking this issue are in a state of such alarm. The Biden administration, the executive branch, can do relatively little, as far as I understand, that can't be undone by the Trump administration. More robust executive orders, are a possibility, but the Trump administration, A, can pass its own executive orders, and B, has just shown an unprecedented disregard for the rule of law. So not only are there existing loopholes, not only can those loopholes be widened, but we may have a set of players coming in based on their own statements who just disregard the entire framework and overreach in various ways. You see a clear, concerted effort in Trump's appointments in this new cabinet and wider administration to circumvent the rule of law. You see the selection of someone like Kash Patel, who it would very clearly give Trump free rein to manipulate law enforcement investigations if he were running the FBI, and has suggested that the executive should have absolute power, has suggested that journalists should be prosecuted.
This is Patel speaking to Steve Bannon on his podcast, The War Room.
We will go out and find the conspirators, not just in government, but in the media. Yes, we're going to come after the people in the media who lied about American citizens, who helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. We're going to come after you. Whether it's criminally or civilly, we'll figure that out. But yeah, we're putting you all on notice. And Steve, this is why they hate us. This is why we're tyrannical. This is why we're dictators, because we're actually going to use the Constitution to prosecute them for crimes they said we have always been guilty of, but never have.
That's Kash Patel, the Trump nominee for head of the FBI to replace Christopher Wray, who was already called on the carpet around buying Pegasus. So when not only Kash Patel, because who knows if he'll make it, but President Trump has repeatedly talked about journalists, for example, as the enemy of the people. Your final thoughts, Ronan?
Trump and his associates have explicitly threatened journalists with prosecution, and specifically threatened journalists who protect their sources with prosecution. That is dangerous for democracy. This is one of the first times, and I'm, as we discussed, someone who's dealt with a fair number of surveillance and intimidation efforts, that I've felt frightened to work in this country. I think in this incoming administration, we're going to need the work of journalists more than ever, and we're going to need the space for journalism, for dissent, for all of the spaces that are shrunk and cracked down on when you have this technology freely used in an unfettered way. And we've just seen this horror story play out in one country after another, even where there are ostensible protections in place. We see how hard it is to get accountability after the fact. We see how tempting it is for law enforcement to overreach and start to target people in a vindictive, politicized way. And then you have these sets of statements where you have Donald Trump threatening political opponents with military tribunals, for instance. And as ever, we're in the media engaged in this debate of what's a joke and what's not. But these kinds of appointments, or at least attempted appointments that we're seeing, are no joke. And this technology that is already at the fingertips of this government, that's no joke. So people need to really care, and members of Congress of whatever party who remain sane in a context that is increasingly not normal really need to clock and appreciate this issue. I have seen in talking about this film in public spaces how the public gets it, how ordinary Americans understand that it is scary to have these spaces shrunk and cracked down on. And I think that politicians who take a stand and realize that the spyware companies in this film who say this is a weapon of war, the spyware companies themselves, we have NSO's lawyer on camera in the film saying there's no equivalent to the Geneva Conventions for this, and that's not on us. We're making and selling a weapon that is largely unregulated. We've got to fix that. And I think people care is what I'm seeing, and my hope is that political representatives understand that the people care. And this is not a partisan issue. You know, people who don't want big government, people who have traditional conservative values, should especially care about protecting people from this tech.
Matt O'Neill, you traveled the world with Ronan as you interviewed people almost on every continent. I want to ask you, for example, about Guatemala. In 2022, a group of journalists working for the award-winning Central American independent news outlet El Faro filed a lawsuit in U.S. court against NSO Group, the Israeli company that operates Pegasus spyware, used to monitor and track journalists, human rights activists, dissidents. The El Faro journalists, which is based in El Salvador, allege Pegasus software was used to infiltrate their iPhones and track their communications and movements. Now, you didn't go to El Salvador. They sued, and one of the heads of it went to Guatemala.
Yes, we went to Guatemala City to interview Roman Gressier, who was targeted by Pegasus spyware. And I think this is indicative of what you see on every continent where Pegasus is in use, is that you're seeing journalists, civil rights activists, human rights activists who are being targeted with this software. If you're looking at El Salvador, this tool is only as responsible as the people using it. So in El Salvador, they're prosecuting journalists. In Saudi Arabia, they're tracking down and executing journalists. If we have this software here, I think people listening at home might be thinking, I'm not going to be subject to an ICE investigation. The Department of Homeland Security isn't interested in my selfies or my pictures of my kids. And that's likely true. However, if this investigative tool makes it into the hands of people who have an expansive idea about what criminality is or what the reach of their institution is into people's lives,
or proudly announce their enemies less they have,
we will all be caught up. We don't need to be the target of an investigation. They could be targeting you, and our text exchange this morning would have looped me right into that.
So if you can talk, Ronan, about what you do, Juan asked you this question before, but really specifically, it amazed me how simple some of it is, and of course, much more complicated to stop this level of spying.
Well, simple, but it's not foolproof. You know, I have been told by senior people within spyware companies that rebooting your phone every day is a great practice.
Why?
It doesn't foil all of these forms of technology. Reboot survivability is built into some of them. But others, including, at least when I last checked in on it, Pegasus, will actually have to reinfect you after a reboot.
Meaning turning your phone off.
Just turning your phone off every day is a good digital hygiene practice. Again, not foolproof. And increasingly, these technologies are more and more sophisticated and can survive reboots, but it will clear out some types of spyware infections. Also, this may seem obvious, but just keep all of your devices updated in every way you can. I mentioned that kind of Mr. Robot digital sniping between the platform holders like Apple and Meta and the spyware companies. What that means is that every single day there is a multi-billion dollar industry that is geared towards finding the vulnerabilities in the latest Apple patch, the latest WhatsApp patch, and exploiting them. And on the other hand, there are teams of sophisticated programmers within the companies that make your software and your hardware that are spending their lives creating those new patches to close up those vulnerabilities. And we see some of those battles in the film, if you're interested in learning more. But the end result is update everything all the time. When you get that little alert, it's annoying, but don't wait.
Aluminum foil?
Well, we follow a scene in the film where a live infection is found of another type of spyware technology, Kandiru, and Citizen Lab investigators race to the scene, and they have the activist who's been infected wrap his laptop, where the infection is taking place, in tinfoil to create a Faraday cage, like you get when elevator doors close and you lose reception, to interrupt the flow of data in and out of the laptop and hopefully prevent a signal from being sent to it that might cause the technology to delete itself. In that case, it was successful. They managed to prevent the technology from self-destructing, and they got a live example of how this infection was working, and it actually helped Microsoft generate a patch that thwarted this technology for a time. So tinfoil, theoretically, or even better, you can get Faraday bags that in secure settings sometimes people use to interrupt transmissions to their devices, can theoretically be a help, but I wouldn't count on it, because you got to wrap those things really thoroughly. And I have also talked to sophisticated technology experts who say, you know what, that's really far from fail-safe.
And Ronan, did you find in your investigation any companies or platforms that had better practices in terms of securing individual phones against surveillance?
Well, yeah, I have been impressed, whatever you think of the wider companies, with the commitment of the programmers who are playing defense on this issue within Apple and within WhatsApp. You know, these companies are sometimes secretive about what they do on this front. Nobody likes to publicize that the device you make or the software you make is so vulnerable. But I'm grateful to the sources within those teams who spoke for this reporting and to the cases in which the companies in question, Microsoft or Meta, for instance, agreed to participate even in the film. You know, we have people going on camera talking about how they do this. I think more openness about this is called for, and that people should celebrate the cases in which companies put resources into protecting their customers in this way. There's not enough, but there is some going on, and that does deserve acknowledgement.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow and Matthew O'Neill talking about their new documentary, Surveilled. It's streaming on Max. It's directed by Perry Peltz, Matthew O'Neill, and produced by Ronan Farrow. We'll link to Ronan Farrow's New Yorker piece, The Technology the Trump Administration Could Use to Hack Your Phone. When we come back, we look at Donald Trump's war on the press. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at Donald Trump's renewed war on the press. The press, which he's often called the enemy of the people. Trump recently sued the Des Moines Register, its parent company Gannett, and the pollster Ann Seltzer for publishing a poll before the election that showed him trailing Kamala Harris in Iowa. While Trump ended up easily winning Iowa, he's now accusing the paper of committing, quote, brazen election interference, unquote. Trump laid out his plans to target the Des Moines Register and other news outlets during a news conference at Mar-a-Lago.
And I feel I have to do this. I shouldn't really be the one to do it. It should have been the Justice Department or somebody else, but I have to do it. It costs a lot of money to do it, but we have to straighten out the press. Our press is very corrupt, almost as corrupt as our elections.
Trump's lawsuit against the Des Moines Register came just days after ABC News, which is owned by Disney, settled a defamation lawsuit filed by the president-elect. The network agreed to donate $15 million to Trump's presidential library and pay $1 million in legal fees to Trump's lawyer. Trump sued ABC after its anchor, George Stephanopoulos, said Trump was found liable for rape in a 2023 civil case in Manhattan brought by writer E. Jean Carroll. ABC has been widely criticized for agreeing to settle instead of going to court to fight what many believe to be a winnable case. The prominent attorney Mark Elias responded to the settlement by writing, "Knee bent, ring kissed, another legacy news outlet chooses obedience." Juan Gonzalez and I recently spoke to Chris Layman, D.C. bureau chief for The Nation, who wrote an article headlined, "Trump's Attack on the Free Press is Just Getting Started." I started out by asking Chris to lay out what's happening.
Well, what's happening is a very clear pattern in Trump's public life. It actually well antedates his rise to political power. He made a practice of frequently going after journalists for defamation. He famously sued one of his biographers who wrote in his this biography that Trump did not qualify as a billionaire. And in his subsequent deposition, Trump basically said he was a billionaire because he felt like a billionaire. This is a longstanding pattern of just intimidation of the press. And Trump was very open as a private business person that that was his aim. He wanted to exert a chilling effect on people doing critical reporting from him. Now, of course, he has the awesome power, the federal government behind him, or prospectively behind him, and ABC disgracefully capitulated right away. And the Des Moines Register suit is a clear auger of what's lying ahead. At the Mar-a-Lago conference you mentioned, Trump also threatened to sue Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, the Pulitzer Prize, Pulitzer Peace Prize committee for these, you know, alleged offenses against basically Trump's bottomless vanity. So by capitulating, you know, sort of preemptively the way ABC has, this news organization has set the stage for a torrent of similar suits like this. You know, Trump will end his henchmen like Kash Patel. Also, Pete Hegseth has threatened a defamation suit against the person alleging sexual assault against him. You know, this will be a prime MO of the second Trump administration. And it's very worrisome that even before Trump takes office, ABC is without cause, you know, giving in. It sends a very distressing signal. In point of fact, what George Stephanopoulos said on the air was just a paraphrase of what the judge in Trump's, in the E. Jean Carroll case, said. He said that even though Trump's conduct in the case did not rise to the strict definition of rape under New York law, any common sense understanding of rape suggests that Trump did, in fact, commit that act. So
the judge said that.
The judge in the case. So there is not, this was not George Stephanopoulos just randomly popping off on the air. It was a documented claim.
And Chris, I wanted to ask you, in the Des Moines Register lawsuit, Trump is alleging consumer fraud by the Des Moines Register as a weapon. Could you talk about that particularly, and also the impact on these media companies, of many of which tend to want to settle just to get rid of a lawsuit?
Right. The fraud charge is, you know, as far as I know, has no legal basis. You can't, you know, just say because a pollster got something wrong, there's some deliberate intent to mislead. It's a plainly frivolous suit, but that is the point. This is a show of power on the part of, an administration that we know from its prior turn in office takes every opportunity to demonize, harass, and intimidate the free press. The Des Moines Register suit is very much like the Trump biography suit I mentioned earlier. It's just his vanity was affronted by poll findings that, you know, turned out to be wrong. You know, I don't know what he can assert the damage has been if he won Iowa by 15 points after this poll was released. It is just a plain effort to harass and intimidate. To its credit, the Register's parent company, unlike Disney, which owns ABC, indicates it will be putting up a robust defense and you know, in a sane court system, they will prevail. But, you know, all of this takes resources and money. And as you mentioned, Juan, you know, big companies don't want to be bothered with the hassle of, you know, going to court, even though, you know, these courts, these companies also have libel insurance precisely for cases like this. And they don't actually, you know, tend to suffer in terms of the bottom line.
I mean, this is extremely serious. When you look at the amount that ABC settled for, they were just about to go to depositions, right, of George Stephanopoulos and Trump, to discovery. So ABC called that off. $15 million plus another million for lawyers' fees. Any smaller news organization couldn't possibly deal with something like this. Then you have these news divisions that are not, profitable. They only profit democracy, but a so-called, financially profitable from these multinational or these very large corporations that are own lots of other things like Bezos with the Washington Post.
Right.
And they care more about that other stuff. They don't want to be seen unfavorably by Trump. So they settle on the news issue. This is so extremely disturbing.
Yeah, and this is what happens when you have large corporations who are not, they don't have journalistic values, they don't have journalistic priorities. As you said, the news operations are lost leaders for these figures. And Jeff Bezos has billions of dollars in government contracts, a publisher of the LA Times. It's the same story. He has extensive pharmaceutical holdings that are come under federal regulation. So he, too, is preemptively knuckling under to the Trump administration. He's killed editorials critical of Trump. He's installed this absurd new feature for readers of the paper to track bias. And he's insisted that anything critical of Trump run alongside in the op-ed section, something that's the opposite point of view. This is more than just callow both sidesism. This is just craven corporate misconduct.
That's and Patrick Soon-Shiong, who owns the Los Angeles Times.
Thank you. Yes. So, this is what happens.
Chris, I wanted to ask you, we only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you about the potential, what Trump could do with the FCC, especially in terms of broadcasters. Are there any concerns in that area?
Oh, absolutely. Cameron Barr, his nominee to head the FCC, is a very vocal critic of, what in MAGA land is considered, mainstream media censorship. He has gone on and on about how big tech in particular is, during COVID and at other times have allegedly suppressed pet MAGA causes and talking points. So, there's a very real and immediate danger of, the call will be coming from inside the White House soon when, Trump's FCC starts implementing policy. And it is all of a piece. It's really important to underline that, what we're going to see, I think, is what happened in Hungary under Orbán's rise to power. Trump and J.D. Vance are both ardent admirers of Viktor Orbán, and Orbán basically used his version of Elon Musk to buy out the national press and turn it into a party propaganda arm. That is a very real and present danger with Trump coming back into power and feeling this kind of impunity and this drive to avenge the people he sees as his enemies. It's crucial that the press hold the line and, follow the example of Des Moines Register and not the example of ABC News.
Chris Layman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation, will link to his piece, Trump's Attack on the Free Press is Just Getting Started. And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Anjali Kamat, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnock, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prue, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, Dante Terrieri, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. Simon Fraser University, the 1960s. In the earliest days of SFU, a renegade, unlicensed radio station begins broadcasting around campus. 1974. Volunteers establish the Simon Fraser Campus Radio Society, which operates CJSF to this day. 1985. The station obtains a cable license, bringing CJSF to a wider audience. And we've been changing the sound of radio in Burnaby ever since.
CJSF.